Now the hidden odorophonics were beginning to blow a wind of odor at the two people in the middle of the baked veldland. The hot straw smell of lion grass, the cool green smell of the hidden waterhole, the great rusty smell of animals, the smell of dust like a red paprika in the hot air. And now the sounds, the thump of distant antelope feet on grassy sod.
This week on Selected Shorts, a virtual reality nursery and murder on the job.
It was just a week to the day since Mr. Martin had decided to rub out Mrs. Old Jean Barrows. The term rub out pleased him because it suggested nothing more than the correction of an error.
I'm Neil Gaiman, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI, the program that brings you great short fiction read live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. Like you, I was a huge fan of Selected Short's irreplaceable host, Isaiah Sheffer, and I had the joy of sharing a stage with him while my stories were being read in front of the audience at Symphony Space. I love short fiction. Short fiction is like close-up magic. You look, you try and figure out how it's done, all the pieces are laid out in front of you, and then suddenly it wraps up in a way that you weren't expecting or in a perfectly satisfying way. And I think the experience of listening to a great short story can be even more fantastic than that of reading it on your own in a room. So I'm delighted to be able to bring you some of the greatest short stories ever written, read by wonderful, wonderful readers. On this program, two American masters, Ray Bradbury and James Thurber. The late science fiction writer Ray Bradbury's story, The Veldt, was first published in 1951 with the title The World the Children Made, which is a very good description of what goes on in this very eerie and disturbing tale. Bradbury was a unique master of fantastic fiction. And in The Veldt, he raises some really interesting questions. Are our children our own? And where does technology take them? The Veldt here is performed by political satirist and television host Stephen Colbert.
George, I wish you'd look at the nursery.
What's wrong with it?
I don't know.
Well, then.
I just want you to look at it is all, and call a psychologist in to look at it.
What would a psychologist want with the nursery?
You know very well what he'd want. His wife paused in the middle of the kitchen and watched the stove busily humming to itself, making supper for four. It's just that the nursery is different now than it was.
All right, let's have a look.
They walked down the hall of their soundproofed happy life home, which had cost them $30,000 installed. This house which clothed and fed and rocked them to sleep and played and sang and was good to them. Their approach sensitized a switch somewhere, and the nursery light flicked on when they came within 10 feet of it. Similarly, behind them, in the halls, lights went on and off as they left them behind with a soft automaticity.
Well, said George Hadley.
They stood on the thatched floor of the nursery. It was 40 feet across by 40 feet long and 30 feet high.
It had cost half again as much as the rest of the house, but nothing's too good for our children, George had said.
The nursery was silent. It was as empty as a jungle glade at hot high noon. The walls were blank and two-dimensional. Now, as George and Lydia Hadley stood in the center of the room, the walls began to purr and recede into crystalline distance, it seemed, and presently an African veldt appeared, in three dimensions, on all sides, in color reproduced to the final pebble and bit of straw. The ceiling above them became a deep sky with a hot yellow sun. George Hadley felt the perspiration start on his brow. Let's get out of this sun, he said. It's a little too real, but I don't say anything wrong.
Wait a moment, you'll see, said his wife.
Now the hidden odorophonics were beginning to blow a wind of odor at the two people in the middle of the baked veldland. The hot straw smell of lion grass, the cool green smell of the hidden waterhole, the great rusty smell of animals, the smell of dust like a red paprika in the hot air. And now the sounds, the thump of distant antelope feet on grassy sod, the papery rustling of vultures. A shadow passed through the sky. The shadow flickered on George Hadley's upturned, sweating face. "Filthy creatures," he heard his wife say. "Vultures?" "You see, there are the lions, far over that way. Now they're on their way to the waterhole. They've just been eating," said Lydia. "I don't know what."
"Some animal."
George Hadley put his hand up to shield off the burning light from his squinted eyes. "A zebra or a baby giraffe, maybe."
"Are you sure?"
His wife sounded peculiarly tense.
"No, it's a little late to be sure," he said, amused. "Nothing I can see over there but cleaned bone and the vultures dropping for what's left."
"Did you hear that scream?" she asked.
"No."
"About a minute ago. Sorry, no."
The lions were coming. And again, George Hadley was filled with admiration for the mechanical genius who had conceived this room, a miracle of efficiency selling for an absurdly low price. Every home should have one.
Oh, occasionally they frightened you with their clinical accuracy. They startled you, gave you a twinge, but most of the time, what fun for everyone, not only for your own son and daughter, but for yourself as well, when you felt like a quick jaunt to a foreign land, a quick change of scenery. Well, here it was.
And here were the lions now, 15 feet away, so real, so feverishly and startlingly real that you could feel the prickling fur on your hand. And your mouth was stuffed with the dusty upholstery smell of their heated pelts, and the yellow of them was in your eyes like the yellow of an exquisite French tapestry. The yellow of lions and summer grass, and the sound of the matted lion lungs exhaling on the silent noontide, and the smell of meat from the panting, dripping mouths. The lion stood looking at George and Lydia Hadley with terrible green-yellow eyes.
"Watch out!" screamed Lydia. The lions were running at them. Lydia bolted and ran. Instinctively, George sprang after her.
Outside in the hall with the door slammed, he was laughing and she was crying, and they both stood appalled at the other's reaction.
"George! Lydia!" "Oh, my poor, sweet Lydia. They almost got us.
Walls, Lydia. Remember, crystal walls. That's all they are.
Oh, they look real, I must admit. Africa in your parlor. But it's all dimensional, super reactionary, super sensitive color film and mental tape film behind glass screens. It's all odor of phonics and sonics, Lydia. Here's my handkerchief. I'm afraid."
She came to him and put her body against him and cried steadily,
"Did you see? Did you feel? It's too real."
"Now, Lydia,
you've got to tell Wendy and Peter not to read any more on Africa."
"Of course. Of course."
He patted her.
"Promise?"
"Sure."
"And lock the nursery for a few days until my nerves get settled?
You know how difficult Peter is about that. When I punished him a month ago by locking the nursery even for a few hours, the tantrum he threw. And Wendy, too, they live for the nursery. It's got to be locked. That's all there is to it."
"All right." Reluctantly, he locked the huge door. "You've been working too hard. You need a rest."
I don't know, she said,
blowing her nose, sitting down in a chair that immediately began to rock and comfort her.
"Maybe I don't have enough to do. Maybe I have too much time to think. Why don't we shut the whole house off for a few days and take a vacation?"
"You mean you want to fry eggs for me?"
"Yes." She nodded.
"Darn my socks?"
"Yes."
A frantic, watery-eyed nodding. "And sweep the house?"
"Yes. Yes. Oh, yes."
"But I thought that's why we bought this house, so we wouldn't have to do anything."
"Well, that's just it. I don't feel like I belong here. This house is wife and mother now and nursemaid. Can I compete with an African veldt? Can I give a bath and scrub the children as efficiently or as quickly as the automatic scrub bath can? I cannot. And it isn't just me, it's you. You've been awfully nervous lately."
"Suppose I have been smoking too much."
"You look as if you don't know what to do with yourself in this house either. You smoke a little more every morning and drink a little more every afternoon, and you need a little more sedative every night. You're beginning to feel unnecessary, too."
"Am I?"
He paused and tried to feel inside of himself to see what was really there.
"Oh, George."
She looked beyond him at the nursery door. Those lions can't get out of there, can they? He looked at the door and saw it tremble as if something had jumped against it from the other side. Of course not, he said. At dinner they ate alone, for Wendy and Peter were at a special plastic carnival across town and had televised home to say that they'd be late to go ahead eating. So George Hadley, bemused, sat watching the dining room table produce warm dishes of food from its mechanical interior. We forgot the ketchup, he said.
Sorry,
said a small voice within the table, and ketchup appeared. As for the nursery, thought George Hadley, it wouldn't hurt for the children to be locked out of it for a while. Too much of anything isn't good for anyone, and it was clearly indicated that the children had been spending a little too much time on Africa. That sun. He could feel it on his neck still, like a hot paw. And the lions and the smell of blood. Remarkable how the nursery caught the telepathic emanations of the children's minds and created life to fill their every desire. The children thought lions, and there were lions. The children thought zebras, and there were zebras. Sun, sun, giraffe, giraffe, death and death. That last. He chewed tastelessly on the meat that the table had cut for him. Death thoughts, they were awfully young. Wendy and Peter for death thoughts. Or, no, you were never too young, really. Long before you knew what death was, you were wishing it on someone else. When you were 2 years old, you were shooting people with cap pistols. But this, the long, hot African veldt, the awful death in the jaws of a lion, and repeated again and again? Where are you going? He didn't answer Lydia. Preoccupied, he let the lights glow softly on ahead of him, extinguished behind him as he padded to the nursery door. He listened against it. Far away, a lion roared. He unlocked the door and opened it. Just before he stepped inside, he heard a faraway scream, and then another roar from the lions, which subsided quickly. He stepped into Africa. How many times in the last year had he opened this door and found Wonderland, Alice the Mock Turtle, or Aladdin in his magic lamp, or Jack Pumpkinhead of Oz, or Dr. Doolittle, or the cow jumping over a very real appearing moon, all the delightful contraptions of a make-believe world? How often had he seen Pegasus flying in the sky ceiling, or seen fountains of red fireworks, or heard angel voices singing? But now, this yellow-hot Africa, this bake-oven with murder in the heat. Perhaps Liddy was right. Perhaps they needed a little vacation from the fantasy, which was growing a bit too real for 10-year-old children. It was all right to exercise one's mind with gymnastic fantasies, but when the lively child mind settled on one pattern, it seemed that at a distance for the past month he had heard lions roaring and smelled their strong odor seeping as far away as his study door. But being busy, he had paid it no attention. George Hadley stood on the African grasslands alone. The lions looked up from their feeding, watching him. The only flaw in the illusion was the open door through which he could see his wife far down the hall like a framed picture eating her dinner abstractedly. "Go away," he said to the lions. They did not go. He knew the principle of the room exactly. You send out your thoughts, whatever you thought would appear. "Let's have Aladdin and his lamp," he snapped. The Veltlin remained. The lions remained. "Come on, room, I demand Aladdin," he said. Nothing happened. The lions mumbled in their baked pelts. "Aladdin!" He went back to dinner. "The full room's out of order," he said. "It won't respond." Or what? "Or it can't respond," said Lydia, "because the children have thought about Africa and the lions and killing so many days that the room's in a rut." "Well, could be." "Or Peter set it to remain that way."
"Set it?"
"He may have got into the machinery and fixed something."
"Peter doesn't know machinery."
"He's a wise one for 10. That IQ of his..."
"Nevertheless..."
"Hello, Mom. Hello, Dad."
The Hadleys turned. Wendy and Peter were coming in the front door, cheeks like peppermint candy, eyes like bright blue agate marbles, the smell of ozone on their jumpers from their trip in the helicopter. "You're just in time for supper," said both parents. "We're full of strawberry ice cream and hot dogs," said the children, holding hands, "but we'll sit and watch." "Come tell us about the nursery," said George Hadley. The brother and sister blinked at him and then at each other.
"Nursery?"
"All about Africa and everything," said the father with false joviality.
"I don't understand,"
said Peter. "Your mother and I were just traveling through Africa with Rod and Reel, Tom Swift and his electric lion," said George Hadley.
"There's no Africa in the nursery," said Peter simply.
"Oh, come now, Peter, we know better."
"I don't remember any Africa," said Peter to Wendy.
"Do you?"
"No." "Run, see, and come tell."
She obeyed. "Wendy, come back here," said George Hadley, but she was gone. The house lights followed her like a flock of fireflies. Too late, he realized he had forgotten to lock the nursery door after his last inspection.
"Wendy'll look and come tell us," said Peter.
"She doesn't have to tell me. I've seen it."
"I'm sure you're mistaken, Father."
"I'm not, Peter. Come along now." But Wendy was back.
"It's not Africa,"
she said breathlessly. "We'll see about this," said George Hadley, and they all walked down the hall together and opened the nursery door. There was a green, lovely forest, a lovely river, a purple mountain, high voices singing, and Rima, lovely and mysterious, lurking in the trees with colorful flights of butterflies like animated bouquets lingering in her long hair. The African Veltlin was gone. The lions were gone. Only Rima was there now, singing a song so beautiful that it brought tears to your eyes. George Hadley looked in at the changed scene. "Go to bed," he said to the children. They opened their mouths. "You heard me," he said. They went off to the air closet where the wind sucked them like brown leaves up the flue to their slumber rooms. George Hadley walked through the singing glade and picked up something that lay in the corner near where the lions had been. He walked slowly back to his wife.
"What is that?" she asked.
"An old wallet of mine," he said.
He showed it to her. The smell of hot grass was on it and the smell of a lion. There were drops of saliva on it. It had been chewed and there were blood smears on both sides.
He closed the nursery door and locked it tight. In the middle of the night, he was still awake, and he knew his wife was awake.
"Do you think Wendy changed it?"
she said at last in the dark room. "Of course."
"Made it from a veldt into a forest and put Rima there instead of the lions?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"I don't know. But it's staying locked until I find out."
"How did your wallet get there?"
"I don't know anything," he said, "except that I'm beginning to be sorry that we bought that room for the children. If the children are neurotic at all, a room like that,
it's supposed to help them work off their neuroses in a helpful way."
"I'm starting to wonder." He stared at the ceiling.
"We've given the children everything they ever wanted. Is this our reward? Secrecy? Disobedience?"
"Who said it? Children are carpets. They should be stepped on occasionally." "We've never lifted a hand. They're insufferable. Let's admit it. They come and go when they like. They treat us as if we were offspring. They're spoiled and we're spoiled."
"They've been acting very funny ever since you forbade them to take the rocket to New York a few months ago."
"They're not old enough to do that alone," I explained.
"Nevertheless, I've noticed they've been decidedly cool toward us since."
"I think I'll have David McLean come tomorrow morning and have a look at Africa."
"But it's not Africa now. It's Green Mansions country in Rima."
"I have a feeling it'll be Africa again before then."
A moment later, they heard the screams. Two screams. Two people screaming from downstairs. And then a roar of lions. "Wendy and Peter aren't in their rooms," said his wife.
He lay in his bed with his beating heart. "Nope," he said. "They've broken into the nursery."
"Those screams, they sound familiar."
"Do they?"
"Yes, awfully."
And although their beds tried very hard, the two adults couldn't be rocked to sleep for another hour. A smell of cats was in the night air.
"Father,"
said Peter. "Yes?"
Peter looked down at his shoes. He never looked at his father anymore, nor at his mother. "You aren't going to lock up the nursery for good, are you?"
"Well, that all depends."
"On what?" snapped Peter.
"On you and your sister. If you intersperse this Africa with a little variety, oh, Sweden, perhaps, or Denmark, or China, I thought we were free to play as we wished." "You are within reasonable bounds."
"What's wrong with Africa, father?"
"Oh, so now you admit you've been conjuring up Africa, do you?"
"I wouldn't want the nursery locked up," said Peter coldly, "ever.
As a matter of fact, we're thinking of turning the whole house off for about a month. Live sort of a carefree one-for-all existence."
"That sounds dreadful. Why, I would have to tie my shoes instead of letting the shoe tire do it, and brush my own teeth and comb my hair and give myself a bath."
"It would be fun for a change, don't you think?"
"No, it would be horrid. I didn't like it when you took out the picture painter last month."
"That's because I wanted you to learn to paint all by yourself, son.
I don't want to do anything but look and listen and smell. What else is there to do?"
"All right, go play in Africa."
"Will you shut off the house sometime soon?"
"We're considering it."
"I don't think you'd better consider it anymore, father."
"I won't have any threats from my son."
"Very well."
And Peter strolled off to the nursery.
"Am I on time?" said David McLean.
"Breakfast?" said George Hadley.
"Thanks, had some. What's the trouble?"
"David, you're a psychologist."
"I should hope so."
"Well, then have a look at our nursery. You saw it a year ago when you dropped by. Did you notice anything peculiar about it then?" "Can't say that I did. The usual violences, a tendency toward a slight paranoia here and there, usual in children because they feel persecuted by parents constantly, but oh, really nothing."
They walked down the hall.
"I locked the nursery up," explained the father. "And the children broke back into it during the night, and I let them stay so they could form the patterns for you to see."
There was a terrible screaming from the nursery.
"Here it is," said George Hadley. "See what you make of it."
They walked in on the children without rapping. The screams had faded. The lions were feeding.
"Run outside a moment, children," said George Hadley. "No, don't change the mental combination. Leave the walls as they are. Get."
With the children gone, the two men stood studying the lions clustered at a distance, eating with great relish whatever it is they had caught.
"I wish I knew what it was," said George Hadley. "Sometimes I can almost see. Do you think if I brought high-powered binoculars here in?"
David McLean laughed dryly.
"Hardly."
He turned to study all four walls. "How long has this been going on?"
"A little over a month."
"Certainly doesn't feel good."
"I want facts, not feelings."
"My dear George, a psychologist never saw a fact in his life. He only hears about feelings, vague things."
"This doesn't feel good, I tell you. Trust my hunches and my instincts. I have a nose for something bad. This is very bad." "My advice to you is to have the whole damn room torn down and your children brought to me every day during the next year for treatment."
"Is it that bad?"
"I'm afraid so. One of the original uses for these nurseries was so that we could study the patterns left on the walls by the child's mind, study at our leisure and help the child. In this case, however, the room has become a channel toward destructive thoughts instead of a release away from them."
"Didn't you sense this before?"
"I sensed only that you had spoiled your children more than most, and now you're letting them down in some way."
"What way?"
"I wouldn't let them go to New York."
"What else?"
"I've taken a few machines from the house and threatened them a month ago with closing up the nursery unless they did their homework. I did close it for a few days to show I meant business."
"Aha!"
"Does that mean something?"
"Everything. Where before they had a Santa Claus, now they have a Scrooge. Children prefer Santas. You've let this room and this house replace you and your wife and your children's affections. This room is their mother and father, far more important in their lives than their real parents, and now you come along and want to shut it off. No wonder there's hatred here. You can feel it coming out of the sky. Feel that sun. George, you'll have to change your life. Like too many others, you've built it around creature comforts. Why, you'd starve tomorrow if something went wrong with your kitchen. You wouldn't know how to tap an egg. Nevertheless, turn everything off. Start new. It'll take time, but we'll make good children out of bad in a year. Wait and see."
But won't the shock be too much for the children shutting the room up abruptly for good?
I don't want them going any deeper into this, that's all.
The lions were finishing with their red feast. The lions were standing on the edge of the clearing watching the two men.
Now I'm feeling persecuted, said McLean. Let's get out of here. I never cared for these damn rooms. Make me nervous.
Lions look real, don't they? Said George Hadley.
I don't suppose there's any way...
What?
That they could become real.
Not that I know.
Some flaw in the machinery, a tampering or something.
No.
They went to the door. I don't imagine the room will like being turned off, said the father.
Nothing ever likes to die, even a room.
I wonder if it hates me for wanting to switch it off.
Paranoia is thick around here today, said David McLean. You can follow it like a spore. Hello.
He bent and picked up a bloody scarf.
This yours?
No. George Hadley's face went rigid. It belongs to Lydia.
They went to the fuse box together and threw the switch that killed the nursery. The two children were in hysterics. They screamed and pranced and threw things. They yelled and sobbed and swore and jumped at the furniture. You can't do that to the nursery. You can't.
Now, children.
The children flung themselves onto the couch, weeping. George, said Lydia Hadley, turn on the nursery just for a few moments. You can't be so abrupt.
No.
You can't be so cruel.
Lydia, it's off and it stays off. And the whole damn house dies as of here and now. The more I see of this mess we've put ourselves in, the more it sickens me. We've been contemplating our mechanical, electronic navels for too long. My God, how we need a breath of honest air.
And he marched about the house, turning off the voice clocks, the stoves, the heaters, the shoe shiners, the shoe lacers, the body scrubbers and swabbers and massagers, and every other machine he could put his hand to. The house was full of dead bodies, it seemed. It felt like a mechanical cemetery, so silent. None of the humming, hidden energy of machines waiting to function at the tap of a button.
Don't let them do it! Wailed Peter at the ceiling as if he was talking to the house, the nursery.
Don't let Father kill everything!
He turned to his father. Oh, I hate you!
Insults won't get you anywhere.
I wish you were dead!
We were for a long while. Now we're going to really start living. Instead of being handled and massaged, we're going to live.
Wendy was still screaming, and Peter joined her again. Just a moment, just one moment, just another moment of nursery,
they wailed.
Oh, George, said the wife, it can't hurt.
All right, if we'll just shut up. 1 minute, mind you, then off forever.
Daddy, 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 sang the children, smiling with wet faces.
And then we're going on vacation. David McLean is coming back in half an hour to help us move out and get to the airport. I'm going to dress. You turn on the nursery for a minute, Lydia. Just a minute, mind you.
And the three of them went babbling off while he let himself be vacuumed upstairs through the air flu and set about dressing himself. A minute later, Lydia appeared.
I'll be glad when we get away, she sighed.
Did you leave them in the nursery?
I wanted to dress, too. Oh, that horrid Africa. What can they see in it?
Well, in 5 minutes, we'll be on our way to Iowa. Lord, how did we ever get in this house? What prompted us to buy a nightmare?
Pride. Money. Foolishness.
I think we'd better get downstairs before those kids get engrossed with those damn beasts again. Just then, they heard the children calling,
Daddy! Mommy! Come quick! Quick!
They went downstairs and the air flew and ran down the hall. The children were nowhere in sight. Wendy? Peter?
They ran into the nursery. The Veltlin was empty, save for the lions waiting, looking at them.
Peter? Wendy?
The door slammed.
Wendy? Peter? George Hadley and his wife whirled and ran back to the door. Open the door! Cried George Hadley, trying the knob.
Why, they've locked it from the outside.
Peter! He beat at the door. Open up!
He heard Peter's voice outside the door. Don't let them switch off the nursery in the house, he was saying.
Mr. and Mrs. George Hadley beat at the door.
Now, don't be ridiculous, children. It's time to go. Mr. McLean will be here in a minute, and
then they heard the sounds. The lions on three sides of them, in the yellow veldt grass, padding through the dry straw, rumbling and roaring in their throats. The lions. Mr. Hadley looked at his wife, and they turned and looked back at the beasts, edging slowly forward, crouching, tails stiff. Mr. and Mrs. Hadley screamed. And suddenly, they realized why those other screams had sounded familiar.
"Well, here I am," said David McLean in the nursery doorway. "Oh, hello."
He stared at the two children seated in the center of the open glade, eating a little picnic lunch. Beyond them was the water hole and the yellow veldtland. Above was the hot sun. He began to perspire.
"Where are your father and mother?"
The children looked up and smiled. "Oh, they'll be here directly."
"Good, we must be going."
At a distance, Mr. McLean saw the lions fighting and clawing and then quieting down to feed in silence under the shady trees. He squinted at the lions with his hand tipped to his eyes. Now the lions were done feeding. They moved to the waterhole to drink. A shadow flickered over Mr. McLean's hot face. Many shadows flickered. The vultures were dropping down the blazing sky.
"A cup of tea?"
asked Wendy, in the silence.
That was Stephen Colbert performing Ray Bradbury's The Veldt. I'm Neil Gaiman. After a brief break, James Thurber's take on office politics. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. I'm Neil Gaiman. For more information about the stories you're hearing, the readers who are reading them, or about the Selected Shorts writing contest, you can go to selectedshorts.org or wnyc.org/shorts and please write and tell us what you think of today's program. Ray Bradbury's The Veldt put a new spin on model homes and dysfunctional families. Now humorist James Thurber takes office politics to extremes in The Catbird Seat, one of my favorite short stories. And I think it's one of my favorites because almost nothing happens. It's just an examination of character. Leonard Nimoy lets rip in James Thurber's glorious The Catbird Seat.
Mr. Martin bought the pack of Camels on Monday night in the most crowded store on Broadway. It was theater time, and seven or eight men were buying cigarettes. The clerk didn't even glance at Mr. Martin, who put the pack in his overcoat pocket and went out. If any of the staff at F&S had seen him buy the cigarettes, they would have been astonished, for it was generally known that Mr. Martin did not smoke and never had. No one saw him. It was just a week to the day since Mr. Martin had decided to rub out Mrs. Old Jean Barrows. The term rub out pleased him because it suggested nothing more than the correction of an error. In this case, an error of Mr. Fitweiler. Mr. Martin had spent each night of the past week working out his plan and examining it. As he walked home now, he went over it again. For the 100th time, he resented the element of imprecision, the margin of guesswork that entered into the business. The project, as he had worked it out, was casual and bold. The risks were considerable. Something might go wrong anywhere along the line, and therein lay the cunning of his scheme. No one would ever see in it the cautious, painstaking hand of Irwin Martin, head of the filing department at F&S, of whom Mr. Fitwiler had once said, "Man is fallible, but Martin isn't." No one would see his hand, that is, unless it were caught in the act. Sitting in his apartment, drinking a glass of milk, Mr. Martin reviewed his case against Mrs. Olgin Barrows, as he had every night for 7 nights. He began at the beginning. Her quacking voice and braying laugh had first profaned the halls of F&S on March 7th, 1941. Mr. Martin had a head for dates. Old Roberts, the personnel chief, had introduced her as the newly appointed special advisor to the president of the firm, Mr. Fitwiler. The woman had appalled Mr. Martin instantly, but he hadn't shown it. He had given her his dry hand, a look of studious concentration, and a faint smile. "Well," she said, looking at the papers on his desk, "are you lifting the ox cart out of the ditch?" As Mr. Martin recalled that moment over his milk, he squirmed slightly. He must keep his mind on her crimes as a special advisor, not on her peccadilloes as a personality. This he found difficult to do, in spite of entering an objection and sustaining it. The faults of the woman, as a woman, kept chattering on in his mind like an unruly witness. She had for almost 2 years now baited him. In the halls, in the elevator, even in his own office, into which she romped now and then like a circus horse, she was constantly shouting these silly questions at him. "Are you lifting the ox cart out of the ditch? Are you tearing up the pea patch? Are you hollering down the rain barrel? Are you scraping around the bottom of the pickle barrel? Are you sitting in the catbird seat?" It was Joey Hart, one of Mr. Martin's two assistants, who had explained what the gibberish meant. "She must be a Dodger fan," he said. "Red Barber announces the Dodger games over the radio, and he uses those expressions. Picked them up down south." Joey had gone on to explain one or two. Tearing up the pea patch meant going on a rampage. Sitting in the catbird seat meant sitting pretty, like a batter with 3 balls and no strikes on him. Mr. Martin dismissed all this with an effort. It had been annoying. It had driven him near to distraction, but he was too solid a man to be moved to murder by anything so childish. It was fortunate, he reflected, as he passed on to the important charges against Mrs. Barrows, that he had stood up under it so well. He'd maintained always an outward appearance of polite tolerance. "Why, I even believe you like the woman," Miss Paird, his other assistant, had once said to him. He simply smiled. A gavel rapped in Mr. Martin's mind, and the case proper was resumed. Mrs. Olgin Barrows stood charged with willful, blatant, and persistent attempts to destroy the efficiency and system of F&S. It was competent, material, and relevant to review her advent and rise to power. Mr. Martin had got the story from Miss Paird, who seemed always to be able to find things out. According to her, Mrs. Barrows had met Mr. Fitwiler at a party where she had rescued him from the embraces of a powerfully built, drunken man who had mistaken the president of F&S for a famous retired Middle Western football coach. She had led him to a sofa and somehow worked upon him a monstrous magic. The aging gentleman had jumped to the conclusion there and then that this was a woman of singular attainments, equipped to bring out the best in him and in the firm. A week later, he'd introduced her into F&S as his special advisor. On that day, confusion got its foot in the door. After Miss Tyson, Mr. Brundage, and Mr. Bartlett had been fired, and Mr. Munson had taken his hat and stalked out, mailing his resignation later, old Roberts had been emboldened to speak to Mr. Fitwiler. He mentioned that Mr. Munson's department had been a little disrupted, and hadn't they perhaps better resume the old system here? Mr. Fitwiler had said certainly not. He had the greatest faith in Mrs. Barrow's ideas.
They require a little seasoning. Little seasoning is all, he'd added. Mr. Roberts had given it up. Mr. Martin reviewed in detail all the charges wrought by Mrs. Barrows. She had begun chipping at the cornices of the firm's edifice, and now she was swinging at the foundation stones with a pickaxe. Mr. Martin came now in his summing up to the afternoon of Monday, November 2nd, 1942, just 1 week ago. On that day at 3 p.m., Mrs. Barrows had bounced into his office. Boo! She had yelled. Are you scraping around the bottom of the pickle barrel? Mr. Martin had looked at her from under his green eye shade, saying nothing. She'd begun to wander about the office, taking it in with her great popping eyes. Do you really need all these filing cabinets? She had demanded suddenly. Mr. Martin's heart had jumped. Each of these files, he had said, keeping his voice even, plays an indispensable part in the system of F&S. She had brayed at him. Well, don't tear up the pea patch. And gone to the door. From there she had bawled, but you sure have got a lot of fine scrap in here. Mr. Martin could no longer doubt that the finger was on his beloved department. Her pickaxe was on the upswing, poised for the first blow. It had not come yet. He'd received no blue memo from the enchanted Mr. Fitwiler, bearing nonsensical instructions deriving from the obscene woman. But there was no doubt in Mr. Martin's mind that one would be forthcoming. He must act quickly. Already a precious week had gone by. Mr. Martin stood up in his living room, still holding his milk glass. Gentlemen of the jury, he said to himself, I demand the death penalty for this horrible person. The next day, Mr. Martin followed his routine as usual. He polished his glasses more often and once sharpened an already sharp pencil, but not even Miss Paird noticed. Only once did he catch sight of his victim. She swept past him in the hall with a patronizing, Hi! At 5:30, he walked home as usual and had a glass of milk, as usual. He had never drunk anything stronger in his life, unless you could count ginger ale. The late Sam Schlosser, the S of F&S, had praised Mr. Martin at a staff meeting several years before for his temperate habits. Our most efficient worker neither drinks nor smokes, he had said. The results speak for themselves. Mr. Fitwiler had sat by, nodding approval. Mr. Martin was still thinking about that red letter day as he walked over to the Schrafts on Fifth Avenue near 46th Street. He got there, as he always did, at 8 o'clock. He finished his dinner and the financial page of the Sun at 8:45, as he always did. It was his custom after dinner to take a walk. This time, he walked down Fifth Avenue at a casual pace. His gloved hands felt moist and warm, his forehead cold. He transferred the Camels from his overcoat to a jacket pocket. He wondered, as he did so, if they did not represent an unnecessary note of strain. Mrs. Barrows smoked only Luckies. It was his idea to puff a few puffs on a Camel after the rubbing out, stub it out in the ashtray, holding her lipstick-stained Luckies, and thus drag a small red herring across the trail. Perhaps it was not a good idea. It would take time. He might even choke too loudly. Mr. Martin had never seen the house on West 12th Street where Mrs. Barrows lived, but he had a clear enough picture of it. Fortunately, she had bragged to everybody about her ducky first-floor apartment in the perfectly darling three-storied red brick. There would be no doorman or other attendants, just the tenants of the second and third floors. As he walked along, Mr. Martin realized that he would get there before 9:30. He had considered walking north on Fifth Avenue from Schrafts to a point from which it would take him until 10 o'clock to reach the house. At that hour, people were less likely to be coming in or going out, but the procedure would have made an awkward loop in the straight thread of his casualness, and he had abandoned it. It was impossible to figure when people would be entering or leaving the house anyway. There was a great risk at any hour. If he ran into anybody, he would simply have to place the rubbing out of old Jean Barrows in the inactive file forever. The same thing would hold true if there was someone in her apartment. In that case, he would just say that he'd been passing by, recognized her charming house, and thought to drop in. It was 18 minutes after 9 when Mr. Martin turned into 12th Street. A man passed him, and a man and a woman talking. There was no one within 50 paces when he came to the house halfway down the block. He was up the steps and in the small vestibule in no time, pressing the bell under the card that said, Mrs. Eugene Barrows. When the clicking in the lock started, he jumped forward against the door. He got inside fast, closing the door behind him. A bulb in a lantern hung from the hall ceiling on a chain seemed to give a monstrously bright light. There was nobody on the stair, which went up ahead of him along the left wall. A door opened down the hall in the wall on the right. He went toward it swiftly on tiptoe.
"Well, for God's sake, look who's here," bawled Mrs. Barrows. And her braying laugh rang out like the report of a shotgun. He rushed past her like a football tackle, bumping her. "Hey, quit shoving," she said, closing the door behind them. They were in her living room, which seemed to Mr. Martin to be lighted by 100 lamps. "What's after you?" she said. "You're as jumpy as a goat." He found he was unable to speak. His heart was wheezing in his throat. Yes, he finally brought out. She was jabbering and laughing as she started to help him off with his coat. No, he said. I'll put it here." He took it off and put it on a chair near the door. "Your hat and gloves, too," she said. "You're in a lady's house." He put his hat on top of the coat. Mrs. Barrows seemed larger than he had thought. He kept his gloves on. "I was passing by," he said. "I recognized... Is there anyone here?" She laughed louder than ever. "No," she said, "we're all alone. You're as white as a sheet, you funny man. Whatever has come over you, I'll mix you a toddy." She started toward a door across the room. "Scotch and soda be all right, but say, you don't drink, do you?" She turned and gave him her amused look. Mr. Martin pulled himself together. "Scotch and soda will be all right," he heard himself say. He could hear her laughing in the kitchen. Mr. Martin looked quickly around the living room for the weapon. He had counted on finding one there. There were andirons and a poker and something in a corner that looked like an Indian club. None of them would do. It couldn't be that way. He began to pace around. He came to a desk. On it lay a metal paper knife with an ornate handle. Would it be sharp enough? He reached for it and knocked over a small brass jar. Stamps spilled out of it and fell to the floor with a clatter. "Hey," Mrs. Barrows yelled from the kitchen. "Are you tearing up the pea patch?" Mr. Martin gave a strange laugh. Picking up the knife, he tried its point against his left wrist. It was blunt. It wouldn't do. When Mrs. Barrows reappeared, carrying two highballs, Mr. Martin, standing there with his gloves on, became acutely conscious of the fantasy he had wrought. Cigarettes in his pocket, a drink prepared for him, it was all too grossly improbable. It was more than that. It was impossible. Somewhere, in the back of his mind, a vague idea stirred, sprouted. "For heaven's sake, take off those gloves," said Mrs. Barrows. "I always wear them in the house," said Mr. Martin. The idea began to bloom, strange and wonderful. She put the glasses on a coffee table in front of a sofa and sat on the sofa. "Come over here, you odd little man," she said. Mr. Martin went over and sat beside her. It was difficult getting a cigarette out of the pack of Camels, but he managed it. She held a match for him, laughing. "Well," she said, handing him his drink, "this is perfectly marvelous. You, with a drink and a cigarette." Mr. Martin puffed, not too awkwardly, and took a gulp of the highball. "I drink and smoke all the time," he said. He clinked his glass against hers. "Here's nuts to that old windbag, Fitwiler," he said, and gulped again. The stuff tasted awful, but he made no grimace. "Really, Mr. Martin," she said, her voice and posture changing, "you are insulting our employer." Mrs. Barrows was now all special advisor to the president. "I'm preparing a bomb," said Mr. Martin, "which will blow the old goat higher than hell." He had only had a little of the drink, which was not strong. It couldn't be that. "Do you take dope or something?" Mrs. Barrows asked coldly. "Heroin," said Mr. Martin. "I'll be coked to the gills when I bump that old buzzard off." "Mr. Martin," she shouted, getting to her feet. "That will be all of that. You must go at once." Mr. Martin took another swallow of his drink. He tapped his cigarette out in the ashtray, put the pack of Camels on the coffee table, and then he got up. She stood glaring at him. He walked over and put on his hat and coat. "Not a word about this," he said, and he laid an index finger against his lips. All Mrs. Barrows could bring out was, "Really?" Mr. Martin put his hand on the doorknob. "I'm sitting in the catbird seat," he said. He stuck his tongue out at her, and he left. Nobody saw him go. Mr. Martin got to his apartment walking well before 11. No one saw him go in. He had 2 glasses of milk after brushing his teeth, and he felt elated. It wasn't tipsiness because he hadn't been tipsy. Anyway, the walk had worn off all effects of the whiskey. He got in bed and read a magazine for a while. He was asleep before midnight. Mr. Martin got to the office at 8:30 the next morning, as usual. At 9:15, Aldergene Barrows, who had never before arrived at work before 10, swept into his office. "I'm reporting to Mr. Fitwiler now," she shouted. "If he turns you over to the police, it's no more than you deserve." Mr. Martin gave her a look of shocked surprise. "I beg your pardon," he said. Mrs. Barrows snorted and bounced out of the room, leaving Miss Paird and Joey Hart staring after her. "What's the matter with that old devil now?" asked Miss Paird. "I have no idea," said Mr. Martin, resuming his work. The other two looked at him and then at each other. Miss Paird got up and went out. She walked slowly past the closed door of Mr. Fitwiler's office. Mrs. Barrows was yelling inside, but she was not braying. Miss Paird could not hear what the woman was saying. She went back to her desk. 45 minutes later, Mrs. Barrows left the president's office and went into her own, shutting the door. It wasn't until 30 minutes later that Mr. Fitwiler sent for Mr. Martin. The head of the filing department, neat, quiet, attentive, stood in front of the old man's desk. Mr. Fitwiler was pale and nervous. He took off his glasses and he twiddled them. He made a small bruffing sound in his throat. Martin, he said, "you've been with us more than 20 years. 22, sir," said Mr. Martin. In that time," pursued the president, "your work and your manner have been exemplary." "I trust so, sir," said Mr. Martin. "I've understood," Martin said, "Mr. Fitwiler, that you have never taken a drink or smoked." "That is correct, sir," said Mr. Martin. Yes, Mr. Fitwiler polished his glasses. You may describe what you did after leaving the office yesterday, Martin." Mr. Martin allowed less than a second for his bewildered pause. "Certainly, sir," he said. "I walked home. Then I went to Schraft's for dinner. Afterward, I walked home again. I went to bed early, sir, and read a magazine for a while. I was asleep before 11. Yes, said Mr. Fitwiler again. He was silent for a moment, searching for the proper words to say to the head of the filing department. "Mrs. Barrows," he said finally, "Mrs. Barrows has worked hard, Martin, very hard, and it grieves me to report that she has suffered a severe breakdown. It has taken the form of a persecution complex, accompanied by distressing hallucinations." "I'm very sorry, sir," said Mr. Martin. Mrs. Barrows is under the delusion," continued Mr. Fitwiler, "that you visited her last evening and behaved yourself in an unseemly manner." He raised his hand to silence Mr. Martin's little pained outcry. It is the nature of these psychological diseases," Mr. Fitwiler said, "to fix upon the least likely and most innocent party as the source of persecution. These matters are not for the lay mind to grasp, Martin. I've just had my psychiatrist, Dr. Fitch, on the phone. He would not, of course, commit himself, but he had made enough generalizations to substantiate my position and my suspicions. I suggested to Mrs. Barrows, when she had completed her story to me this morning, that she visit Dr. Fitch, for I suspected a condition at once. She flew, I regret to say, into a rage, and demanded, requested that I call you on the carpet. You may not know, Martin, but Mrs. Barrows had planned a reorganization of your department. Subject to my approval, of course, subject to my approval. This brought you rather than anyone else to her mind, but again, that is a phenomenon for Dr. Fitch and not for us, Mr. Martin. So I'm afraid Mrs. Barrows' usefulness here is at an end." "I'm dreadfully sorry, sir," said Mr. Martin. It was at this point that the door to the office blew open with the suddenness of a gas main explosion, and Mrs. Barrows catapulted through it. "Is the little rat denying it?" she said. "He can't get away with that." Mr. Martin got up and moved discreetly to a point beside Mr. Fitwiler's chair. You drank and you smoked at my apartment, she bawled at Mr. Martin, and you know it. You called Mr. Fitwiler an old windbag and said you were going to blow him up when you got coke to the gills on your heroin. She stopped yelling to catch her breath, and a new glint came into her popping eyes. If you weren't such a drab, ordinary little man, she said, I think you planned it all, sticking your tongue out, saying you were sitting in the catbird seat because you thought no one would believe me when I told it. My God, it's really all too perfect. She brayed loudly and hysterically, and the fury was on her again. She glared at Mr. Fitwiler. Can't you see how he's tricked us, you old fool? Can't you see his little game? But Mr. Fitwiler had been surreptitiously pressing all the buttons under the top of his desk. And employees of F&S began pouring into the room. Stockton, said Mr. Fitwiler, you and Fishbein will take Mrs. Barrows to her home. Mrs. Powell, you'll go with them. Stockton, who'd played a little football in high school, blocked Mrs. Barrows as she made for Mr. Martin. It took him and Fishbein together to force her out the door into the hall, crowded with stenographers and office boys. She was still screaming at Mr. Martin, tangled in contradictory imprecations. The hubbub finally died out down the corridor.
I regret that this has happened, said Mr. Fitwiler. I shall ask you to dismiss it from your mind, Mr. Martin. Yes, sir, said Mr. Martin, anticipating his chief's. That will be all by moving to the door. I will dismiss it. He went out and shut the door, and his step was light and quick in the hall. When he entered his department, he had slowed down to his customary gait, and he walked quietly across the room to the W-20 file, wearing a look of studious concentration.
That was Leonard Nimoy, performing James Thurber's The Catbird Seat. I'm Neil Gaiman. Thanks for joining me for Selected Shorts. Next week, Tales of Illusion by Stephen Milhauser and Saki. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and was directed by Isaiah Sheffer. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Jim Briggs III. Our guest commentator is Hannah Tinty. Our production intern is Malcolm Donaldson. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is David Peterson's That's the Deal, performed by the Deardorff Peterson Group. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2012 by Tom Perotta. Additional support has been provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the short story, the Henry Nias Foundation, the New York Community Trusts Program for Performing Arts Groups, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts has also been supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and with public funds from the New York State Council on the Arts. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at Zabars.com/shorts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and from the PRI Program Fund. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.